O Lord, our God, grant that thy law may search our hearts, and that we may also come to recognize its holy reproof. May we also love thy law, meditate therein day and night. We would acknowledge our complete hopelessness before the reproof and the condemnation of thy law, were it not for the perfect satisfaction that thine own Son has given to thy law, and that obedience which is perfect, which is undefiled and undefilable, that righteousness which is acceptable with thee. And do thou grant unto us that clothed in that righteousness, we may emulate more and more the perfection of our Redeemer, who was holy, harmless, undefiled, and separate from sinners. In his name, amen.
Now I will deal with the fourth subdivision of our formulation of the doctrine of sin. I just came to it at the close of the hour, namely the all-pervasiveness of God's law, the all-pervasiveness. And the point there is simply this, that the law of God extends to all relations of life. That we are never in any moment, never in any moment, relieved of the obligation which God's law entails for us. Because there is never a moment, never a circumstance in which we are not under obligation to love and serve God. Love and serve God. And if that is true with respect to love, it must also be true with respect to law, because love and law are correlative, as we found out yesterday. If love is the fulfillment of the law, you never have love but in relationship to law and in the fulfillment of it. Now this is just saying in other terms that we are never amoral or non-moral. We are always either moral or immoral, but never non-moral. Now, it is that principle, the all-inclusive obligation to God, that gives sanctity to all of our subordinate obligations. I say it is this that gives sanctity to all of our subordinate obligations. We do have obligations to our fellow creatures, to our fellow men. Because there are institutions invested with authority
institutions of God's appointment invested with authority. And to them we owe subjection. Within the sphere, we owe subjection within the sphere to which these institutions belong, or the spheres which are defined by these institutions. Now, if these subordinate obligations were not derived obligations, there would be a contradiction. Contradiction entering into human life. To our fellow man within these spheres only because they are divine ordinances. And all subordinate obligation is always traceable. It's always traceable. All subordinate obligation is always traceable to a higher divine obligation. Now you might ask, why deal with this in connection with the subject of sin? Why? Thoroughly germane to our topic. For this reason, that nothing is sin unless it is first of all a violation of that higher divine obligation. Nothing is sin unless it violates that higher divine obligation. It is the truth enunciated in the scripture. There is one lawgiver. One lawgiver. So if the ordinances of man, require us to violate the law of God, then we must obey God rather than man. And therefore, the only criterion of sin is the law of God. We disobey only when the human is in excess of divine institution and authority. But if a human ordinance is a legitimate exercise of God-given authority, then disobedience is sin. Not simply because the act is in violation of the human ordinance, but because the human ordinance is in accordance with divine institution. Now that is the plain effect of the teaching of Paul, for example, in Romans 13:1-7. Let every soul be subject to the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. And he that resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God. He goes on, of course, to speak of conscience. You must needs be subject not only for wrath, but also for conscience sake. Now, conscience, of course, always relates itself to the law of God. God alone is Lord of the conscience. And if we obey out of conscience, it is because we recognize in the human ordinance an exercise of divinely instituted authority. Now, it may be sometimes that human institutions impose ordinances that are in excess of their God-given authority. I say they establish ordinances which are in excess of God-given authority. When these ordinances require us to violate the law of God, then we must, as I said, disobey men and obey God. But if these ordinances of men are in excess of God-given authority, but do not require us to violate the law of God, do not require us to violate the law, then, of course, obedience is a matter of expedience. It may be inexpedient to disobey. It may be expedient to comply. But we must remember this, that if these ordinances are in excess of divine authority, then we may violate them without sin when a higher divine obligation requires us to do so. And that is thoroughly germane to our assessment of what sin really is. Sin must be defined as violation of the law of God, as anomia. Hence, the law by which sin is to be judged is not variable, not variable. Circumstances and conditions will affect the heinousness of violation. Circumstances and conditions do affect the heinousness, the gravity, but circumstances and conditions do not determine what the law of God is. Circumstances and conditions do, of course, determine which aspects of the law of God pertain to us in these circumstances and conditions. I say they determine what is the relevance of the law of God in these situations, but they do not of themselves determine what the law of God is. And that's why you can have in the scripture permanent, invariable principles of divine obligation. And it is these principles enunciated in commandments which are the criteria by which we are to judge sin and sinfulness. Well, that's all on that. Now we come to the fourth main subdivision, capital B. Yes?
Just have one question. Did I understand correctly here that if these powers are in excess of God-given authority, that it is not a sin if we violate them?
No.
All right.
It's not necessarily a sin if we violate them. That is to say, you see, they may be in such excess with God-given authority that the divine law requires us to violate them. And therefore, if they are in excess of God-given authority, they do not necessarily obligate our conscience. That is the point. Now, there are many laws in existence. Many laws in existence in a state that it is inexpedient to violate, but nevertheless, there are circumstances which arise when it is not only proper, but it is an obligation to violate them, because we have that higher divine obligation revolving upon us. And that applies, of course, in many, many situations of life. And consequently, I think it's necessary to liberty of conscience and the discharge of our divine obligations to recognize that fact. Sometimes it is necessary obedience to God to violate, and that not simply when the ordinance is expressly in violation of divine commandment. Of course, sometimes it's expressly in violation. And the magistrates, of course, commanded Peter and his associates to Methodists on preaching the gospel, you remember they said, we must obey God rather than man. The human requisition, the requisition of the magistrates, was expressly in violation of their divine permission. Now, on other occasions, laws on the part of men may not be so blatantly in violation of the law of God, and they may not ordinarily require us to violate the law of God. That is, compliance with them may not ordinarily require us to violate the law of God, and consequently it is expedient that we should obey them as Christians. But sometimes we shall have to disobey consciously and deliberately in order to fulfill our higher divine obligation. Now for the capital day.
Let's see.
No, I said that sin was a real evil, sin was a specific evil, sin was a moral evil, and that is C. And now we come to D. Isn't that correct?
Evil manner of trying man.
Real evil, specific evil, moral evil. Now, this is not me.
You had moral evil as a subject under sin being a specific evil.
That's the way I said it yesterday?
Yes, sir.
Yes,
sir.
Oh, well, then, let you have it that way.
I didn't mean that. I didn't mean that.
But if you all have it that way in your notes, let us adhere to that. It would be simpler. But I didn't mean that, really. I meant really. And if I did that, I slipped up on what I meant to do, because that was my real intent. Real evil, specific evil, moral evil. I may have slipped at that point and not put C on the board. But if you have your notes that way, that's all right. It doesn't make any difference. Instead of messing up your notes, you observe what you happen to have. But that was a slip-up on my part, and it was my fault. Well, we'll just make it this way then. Sin involves pollution, blame, and liability. These three parts. Pollution, blame, and liability.
Now, if you like Latin, do you like Latin, Mr. Voss?
I did.
Are you a Latin hound?
What?
Are you a Latin hound?
Only in so far as I married one.
Macula, pupa, and pena. It's well to remember these three Latin terms, because you come across them.
If you pursue your studies in Latin, you'll come across them in English works, even though you will not read the Latin itself. And a great deal of theology involved in these three expressions.
Well, in English you just call it pollution, blame, liability. Now, pollution. That, of course, as we found already,
refers to the defilement of heart and of mind, the defilement of the disposition of complex, from which all sin proceeds. And it is very important to bear in mind that sin is never a volitional abstraction. Never a volitional abstraction. That is an act of will abstracted from that which is most determinative in the human personality. That which is most determinative in the human personality is the heart, what the Bible calls the heart. That is that which is most determinative morally and religiously. That which is most determinative in the human personality is the heart, what the Bible calls the heart. That is that which is most determinative morally and religiously is the heart. And what is being emphasized here is the depravity of the heart, apart from which no sin exists. Isolate a sinful action from that from which it issues, and it is a pure abstraction that has no reality, that has no existence. Out of the heart are the issues of life. Out of the heart are the issues of death. Well, you can see how important is this aspect of youth, defilement, depravity, natural. Then, secondly, it involves blame. And that simply means that the person is blameworthy for everything that is in contravention of divine obligation. He is blameworthy for everything that is in contravention of divine obligation. And there you can see how important it is, again, to emphasize that aspect of sin. Because in a great deal of pseudo-Christian ethics, there is the tendency to excuse the person. Perhaps because of ignorance, perhaps because of supposedly ameliorating circumstances and conditions under which the sin was committed. But the point here is that wherever there is the contravention of a divine obligation, either by way of omission or commission, either by way of coming short, or by way of overt transgression, there is the blame devolving upon the person of whom that sin is predicated. Well, sir, you have liability, and that refers to the penalty that accrues to the person because of his blameworthy disposition and action. I prefer to call it the judgment of God, the penal judgment devolving upon the person or accruing to the person because of his contravention of the law of God. The judgment, of course, is inevitable because sin is the contradiction of God. And that which is a contradiction of God must elicit God's displeasure, indignation, and wrath. And the judgment of God is always epitomized in his wrath. Now here it is necessary to understand the precise force of a term which you'll always find in theology, Latin term. It is a substantive. And the corresponding adjective is reus, that is reatus. Reatus really means liability. Liability. Sometimes you will find theologians using the expression reatus culpa. Reatus culpa, in distinction from the reatus pena. That is a misuse of the term reatus. Complete misuse of the term reatus. Classic Reformed theology vigorously rejected the distinction between reatus culpae and reatus pena on the ground that reatus is always something intermediate between culpa and pena. Always something intermediate, as Hamastek expresses it quite properly, that reactus is something that arises from culpa and leads to pena, something that arises from culpa and leads to pena, that it arises from blame and leads to penalty. So bear that in mind, that in Reformed theology, reactus is always conceived of as the liability arising from blame or fault. The liability. And therefore, you really speak of reactus penae. That is the liability to penalty, but not of reactus culpa. Now, that's simply to set straight that terminology. In English, we often use this word guilt. Guilt. G-U-I-L-T. But there is a certain ambiguity attaching to the use of that word guilt in our common speech, as also to the adjective guilty. When we say a person is guilty, we mean that he has perpetrated a certain wrong. And we speak of the guilt as synonymous with the sin itself. That is, it is often used to denote the wrong committed. So guilt, in common parlance, is the synonym of transgression. We should not interfere with that common parlance, that common usage, because it is common usage that determines the connotation and denotation of a term. But in theology, the word guilty and also the term guilt is often used to denote the Latin term reactus. And therefore, denoting the liability arising from sin. That is to say, it is often used in theological discussion to denote what in Latin is called obligatio ad finem. Obligatio ad finem. Now, when in theology guilt is used in that restricted sense, bear in mind that that is what it has reference to. It has reference to the obligation, to the judgment of God, which accrues to sin. Now, to conclude our discussion of the whole subject of the nature of sin, including observations, it is very important that our thinking, be oriented to these emphases. Comprehended under these three subdivisions, and I meant four subdivisions, but that doesn't worry us now. Because today he may find a great deal of emphasis upon the undesirability, of sin, the hatefulness of sin, and even the filthiness of sin, without any truly Christian assessment of sin as lawlessness and as involving pollution, blame, and guilt. Using guilt in the more restricted sense, which I've just stated. The biblical estimate of sin is that it is wrong. Not only undesirable, but damnable. And it is that concept of wrong that enshrines in itself, all that I have said respecting sin, this violation of the law of God. And this is also important in our present day context to lay particular emphasis upon the judgment which necessarily attaches to sin as contradiction of God and of his perfection. When sin is conceived of as contradiction of God and of his perfection, then we must appreciate the correlate, namely, that he reacts against it with holy displeasure, with indignation, with wrath and condemnation. We are here confronted with a divine impossibility. And this divine impossibility is not his weakness, but his strength. Not his reproach, but his glory. He cannot deny himself. And therefore, to be complacent towards that which is the contradiction is a divine impossibility. That God is holy, that he is justice, that he is truth, and that he is love. And because he is love, he loves himself supremely. loving himself supreme. He cannot but contradict that which is an assault upon his majesty, dispute with his sovereignty, doubt of his goodness, contradiction of his veracity. Well, let's now to pass on to the next main subdivision of our discussion of the doctrine of sin. The second main subdivision of our discussion is the doctrine of sin. And dealt with the nature of sin, formulated it under these various subdivisions that really mean the definition of what sin is. Now we come to the next main subdivision, and that is the imputation of Adam's sin. The imputation of Adam's sin. This, of course, is concerned with our relationship to the sin of Adam. The imputation of Adam's sin. Now I'm going to be lecturing on this for a week or so, and I will be following the lines of what I have in the little book, The Imputation of Adam's Sin. I won't be bringing in anything really new. You can find everything in there, I shall be saying, for the next week or so. But I could just let you read the book, but I do not think that you would get the material as well as you would if I go over the main point, because there is a great deal in that book that I'm not going to deal with, and I'm afraid you would get lost, especially in the latter part of the book. And so I'm going to lecture on this subject in order to abbreviate and somewhat simplify, and also drive home the main considerations bearing upon this all-important question. Now, in dealing with this subject, there are two passages in particular in the New Testament that bear upon the question. They are not the only passages, but there are two passages in particular, and these are Romans 5, 12 through 19, and 1 Corinthians 15, 22. They are the pivotal passages, and a good deal of the discussion will pertain to the interpretation of Romans 5, 12 through 19. Now, in dealing with that passage, there are five main subdivisions under which I shall assume the discussion. And there are capital A, the syntactical construction, the syntax of the passage. The syntactical construction. Then second, the sin contemplated, that's capital B, the sin contemplated. C, the union involved. The union involved. then D, the nature of the imputation, and then 5, and finally the sin imputed. A, B, C, D, E. The syntactical construction. The sin contemplated, the union involved, the nature of the implication, sin imputed.
Now our discussion of this will involve a great deal of historical theology. And that is required because the discussion of this question is one that can only be dealt with adequately if it is oriented to the questions of historical theology, the questions that emerge in the discussion of this matter in history. Now I bear will ring presently, so I won't go further today.